The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Kids, they grow up so fast. Girls, as it turns out, are growing up even faster. As early as a generation ago, less than 5% of girls went through puberty before the age of 8. Now that percentage has doubled. Joining us to discuss the possible causes and to provide some practical advice for parents when it comes to talking about puberty are the authors of the book, The New Puberty: How to Navigate Early Development in Today's Girls. Dr. Juliana Deardorff, clinical psychologist on the faculty of the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health. And Juliana, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Louise Greenspan is a clinical pediatric endocrinologist. She works at Kaiser San Francisco and is on the faculty at UC San Francisco. Louise, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, to clarify, when we talk about puberty in girls, what does that mean exactly?
What most people think of when they hear the word girls' puberty is first periods. And what people may not understand is that the process actually starts a lot earlier than that. And what we talk about with girls is the first sign of puberty being most commonly breast development, and it can be very subtle. And another common first sign would be pubic hair development.
Now, how early is early?
Well, we're seeing that girls are starting now commonly at age 7 and 8. So we were part of a large study that showed that at age 7, 15% of girls had breast development and 10% had pubic hair development. So it really is starting earlier than we used to think it started.
Well, you said it's not the same as starting their periods, but are girls who are experiencing puberty earlier also starting menses earlier?
Yeah, that's what's interesting, and part of why Louise and I got interested in studying this phenomenon. So girls are starting breast and pubic hair development earlier, but not necessarily menstruation or first period, which we call menarche.
So it looks like puberty might be taking longer.
To me, it sounds very early. Is it something to be concerned about?
Well, early puberty can have some negative downstream effects. So we know that the earlier you are when you have your first period, for example, before age 11 versus after age 14, the higher the risk of breast cancer later in your life. We also know that girls who have early pubertal development are more at risk for eating disorders, depression, earlier sexual activity, and heart disease, and in fact, all-cause mortality. But one thing we really want to make people understand is that those effects aren't necessarily bound to happen, and that parents can do a lot to modify those risks.
Well, let's talk. You've been studying this trend for quite a while, which you call the new puberty, title of your book. And your research points to three different causes, beginning with obesity. What have you found about the connection between early puberty and obesity?
Yeah, we outline in the book that a fat tissue is a very potent endocrine organ or a hormone-secreting organ. And the more fat tissue you have, the more estrogen is produced in your body. So the girls that are more overweight are going to have higher levels of estrogen, which could lead to earlier pubertal development.
And study after study has shown a correlation, a link between overweight and early development. So girls who have higher body weight tend to go through puberty earlier.
Could this be one of the explanations in why we're seeing puberty earlier in girls? I mean, as human beings develop, nutrition gets better, food gets better, but you're talking about obesity.
Yeah, we are. Although it may be along the spectrum that girls that are overweight are also at risk, we do think that this is a large cause of the earlier onset of puberty in girls, but we don't think it's the only cause. We do think that the other triggers or the other factors may be contributing.
Yeah, and it's actually a little different from kind of meeting the nutritional requirements for going through puberty. So there were certainly some large decreases in terms of the age at puberty as countries became more developed and nutrition was more available, or we moved away from situations of malnutrition, for sure. However, this obesity piece, it seems to be a different trajectory that girls are on.
Let's get to some of the other factors. Something that I've heard an awful lot about for, you know, at least the last decade is hormones in the environment. Are they a cause of early puberty?
Simplistically, no. Hormones are not necessarily a cause, but there may be chemicals that are in the environment or in the food that we eat that act like hormones in our body. They're called endocrine disrupting chemicals. So the concern is that exposure to these chemicals may lead to hormone-like actions in our bodies. The problem is that we don't know which chemicals are doing this, and we're all exposed to so many chemicals. So we do think this is a contributing factor, and we actually outline in the book ways to minimize one's exposure to those kinds of chemicals.
What are some of the hormone mimicking or endocrine influencing chemicals that you do identify?
So, again, the research is in its infancy, and we haven't isolated one particular chemical. But some of the ones that we're looking at in our studies are things like flame retardants, pesticides, classes of chemicals called phthalates or phenols. We're also concerned about even some naturally occurring compounds or chemicals, things like soy, lavender, tea tree oil.
Mm-hmm. I've heard about soy, certainly, and bovine growth hormone, for example. Anything conclusive on BGH?
No, there's nothing conclusive on the bovine growth hormone, but we do think that the growth hormone, any that is in any milk, is mostly broken down in the stomach, because even if you give humans human growth hormone, it is broken down in the stomach. That's why children who need, or adults who take it as a medicine, have to use it by injection. So we don't think that's a big culprit. We're more concerned, for example, about the antibiotics that those dairy cows may have been exposed to, because we don't think those are broken down in the stomach.
All right, another factor here, the last of your three causes stress among little girls. Now, what kind of stress, and why would that affect them this way?
So this is kind of a lesser known area of research that's been going on for a while. Now, while we think that stress isn't the primary culprit that would be pushing puberty earlier, because there's always been stress and there's always been issues of stress in families, we do know that girls who grow up in family environments that have low consistency, more instability, higher levels of conflict, and lower levels of warmth tend to go through puberty earlier. And that's been well documented for decades in the literature.
We're talking about some of the reasons why girls today are entering puberty so much earlier than a generation ago. I'm speaking with researchers Juliana Deerdorf and Louise Greenspan. They're co-authors of The New Puberty, How to Navigate Early Development in Today's Girls. Any of these three factors owe to cultural, socioeconomic differences?
Yeah, we actually recently published a big paper looking at socioeconomic status in the United States, and showed that indeed girls who have lower family incomes and certain markers of lower socioeconomic status tend to experience puberty earlier, at least in terms of getting their periods earlier. And there's a couple other studies that have also shown that. What's interesting is those socioeconomic differences also seem to account for some race and ethnicity differences that we see in timing of puberty in the United States.
And how far back do records go on this? When you're talking about doing research, is there anything that we know about when puberty was happening, say, you know, in the early 20th century or even earlier?
You know, not so much. So it's very tricky. The one thing that we can study at least reasonably well with data that is retrospective, looking back, recall, is onset of first period. So with some level of reliability, women can remember around when they got their first period. So we've been able to track that over generations, couple generations. And those data are interesting in terms of menstruation. But for breast and pubic hair, the data are far less reliable and consistent. So we do have some data dating back to, you know, the mid
1900s, would you say, Louise? Yeah. Mm-hmm. However, in our studies that we've been doing more recently, we're doing a clinical examination of the girls. So we can actually palpate their breasts and know that breast tissue is not obesity, for instance. It's really hard to tease those two apart. So the rigor that's needed to know whether a girl is starting breast development early is actually quite high.
Could there be, an evolutionary reason for the pituitary gland kicking in and entering puberty at an earlier age? You know, any sort of advantage to it?
That's interesting. You know, we don't know a ton about the advantages. They haven't been as well studied. However, there is a whole body of work that's been done in evolutionary developmental psychology that says in homes where girls are growing up, where there is less consistency and perhaps more signals of danger, that girls go into puberty early because there's not a whole lot of reason to wait. And mm-hmm. if we're talking about reproduction as the ultimate marker of, you know, kind of success, from an evolutionary perspective at least.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's danger.
Right.
You should reproduce now. You
right.
don't know how long you'll be around. Any indication that this new puberty is happening in other countries?
So there is a wealth of literature coming out in other locations. For example, the Netherlands has studied, and they're showing a similar effect. And other research is also going on in places like Chile and other developed countries. It does look like it's an issue in the developed world.
It's hard to wrap one's head around. I mean, what is your best piece of advice for a parent? You know, how to start the conversation about puberty for girls and boys, too, when they seem so young?
Well, I think, you know, it's part of why we wrote this book. And to arm yourself with knowledge, I think, is the first step for parents. This can be very awkward for parents who haven't had experience talking about these kinds of changes. And, of course, a generation ago, people didn't really talk about this stuff with their kids. It just happened. So arming yourself with knowledge, getting the right kind of material so you know how to get started really helps. And also there's great books for kids as well out there.
How about for boys? Do they have to understand this change in girls as well?
We really advocate for teaching both gendered kids about what's going on. Boys are the peers of girls in almost all schools these days, and they need to understand what's happening with girls' bodies and also the appropriate ways to handle that. And, for example, not snapping girls' bras in fourth grade when there's one girl who wears a bra. We think that can be very traumatic. So we do want to support the boys so that they have the knowledge to react appropriately and treat their peers with kindness.
You do also advocating for using the technical anatomical terms for body parts, even with young children. Why is that important?
You know, we think it's important because we want to all be on the same page, particularly with our kids. And if we start to slip into euphemisms or kind of symbols but not use the real word, we don't know if we're talking about the same thing. I mean, a good example is for menstruation. Like so many folks have historically used words like your visitor or Aunt Flo.
Or the curse,
my goodness. And it really makes more sense to be using the same words, and then they can use those words with their peers and kids can then make more sense out of it.
So any parting advice for, you know, people who are witnessing girls whose bodies are growing up much faster than their brains?
We really recommend treating them as their chronological age. There's such a push to think of them as more advanced or older or more mature if their bodies are developing early. And actually, they may not be socially, emotionally, and cognitively ready for those expectations.
Dr. Juliana Deardorff right there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Juliana Deardorff, clinical psychologist on the faculty of UC Berkeley. And Dr. Louise Greenspan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Louise Greenspan, a clinical pediatric endocrinologist. She also works at Kaiser San Francisco and is on the faculty at UC San Francisco. You can find much more on their book, The New Puberty. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Wearables, the Internet of Things, 3D printing. When Word of Mouth continues, a peek at tech trends predicted to hit the mainstream this year. We'll get a recap of the Consumer Electronics Show right after the break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. David Ewald is author and contributing writer to Forbes magazine, where he writes about games and technology. He has just returned from the International Consumer Electronics Show. That's the flashy congregation of geeks and gadgets and startups held annually in Las Vegas. And joins us now for a quick analysis of what he saw there. David, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So what did you see, David, that was, in your opinion, you know, the hands-down coolest thing at CES?
Well, probably one of the coolest things is something that you can't even buy yet. There's a couple of companies showing off very futuristic televisions. Sharp had one that what they call an 8K television. Outside of looking out a window, it's the best picture I've ever seen on a screen.
Wow. I think I read about one that was like a curved screen television. Did you see one of those?
Yeah, the two big trends, I think, when it comes to screen this year were curved screens and these big 4K screens. So it's high resolution, and the vendors are trying to tell you, oh, you know, you want a curved screen because it's less eye strain. It's always the same viewing distance to whether you're looking at the left side of the screen or the center. I don't know that I believe that it actually is better for your eyes, but some of those curved screens are really beautiful. They're very nice screens. I saw a couple of computer monitors in particular that I was very sort of envious of.
Now, we were told that this was going to be the year of the 3D printer. What'd you see?
There are some amazing 3D printers out there. And this is one of the things that's crazy about going to CES is just, you know, 2 years ago, 3D printers were barely a presence at all at CES. I remember MakerBot, which is now one of the biggest 3D printer providers at the show. They had a little tiny booth at the back of one of the halls where they were, you know, selling their wooden framed 3D printer. But now there's a whole section of the show floor and an array of 3D printers, going from consumer models for a couple $100 that you can sit on your desk and print stuff around the house to very high-tech, very high-precision ones that you might use for building parts for engineering purposes or even aerospace. We're now, this is probably a year where 3D printing is really going to become a mainstream consumer technology. There's a lot of those printers that are pretty easy to use now, and I think it's the kind of stuff people are going to buy and have at home. And, you know, if you break a piece in a kid's toy or, you know, a handle comes off one of your drawers, you can go and print yourself a replacement.
Well, it also seems like the third or even fourth year in a row that we've been hearing about wearable tech being the next big thing. Something that we're not seeing, certainly here in New Hampshire, is it catching on in other places, about to change?
I think so. I think part of what's finally making it happen is some entry from big companies like Apple. You know, Apple announced, oh, they've got the iWatch now. Microsoft has a watch. Samsung has a watch. And fitness trackers, things like that, you know, Fitbit and Nike, those are all part of this environment too. So I think what you're going to see in 2015 is a lot more people wearing watches and sunglasses and bracelets and things like that. And also it kind of just disappearing into other objects. So you might have a wearable, you know, cell phone or a wearable calculator or something, but it won't be just like, okay, this is my cell phone that I clip onto my clothes. It'll be part of the clothes. It'll be part of something else that you're already carrying.
Did you see a lot of people there wearing Google Glass or watches?
You know, I did see people wearing watches and a lot of people wearing fitness bands. I saw almost no one wearing Google Glass. And I think Google kind of missed their window with that product.
Hmm. How about the worst product or idea that you saw at the convention?
So I saw a lot of, you know, sort of silly things. Like there was a company selling a hairbrush that you could snap your phone into and take selfies with as you were brushing your hair. Yeah, it's little things like that. You also run into a lot of weird Asian products. There's a lot of companies from Asia who come either because they're precision manufacturers, company like Foxconn, who does all the manufacturing for Apple, mm-hmm. or who because they have some product that we really can't relate to in the U.S. You know, there was a company selling vibrating exercise machines that kind of looked like Segways, but when you stepped on them, they just shook you like crazy. And I'm not sure how that's supposed to make you lose weight. I think it would just give you a migraine, but it was fun to watch.
Well, David Carr in the New York Times wrote this past weekend that the CES, which he says used to be a kind of nerd curio, has in recent years just become a kind of bonanza for marketers and agencies and media organizations that really don't have so much interest in the technology being showcased. What's your read on that?
I think that's very true. And I think, you know, if you look at the history of a show like CES, 5, 10 years ago, you know, maybe you never had Apple there, but you did have a company like Microsoft showing up. You know, Bill Gates used to give keynote addresses opening day at CES. Bill would be on stage and he would show off, like, here's the new stuff coming from Microsoft this year. You'd have big keynotes from Sony, from Samsung. And while all those companies are still involved with CES, this is no longer the place where they come to debut their latest and greatest stuff. And part of that's because we have the internet now and we have other events. You know, Microsoft can just throw their own event. They can put it up on the internet and stream it. And anybody who wants to see, hey, Microsoft is going to announce their new watch or their new high-tech shoes, anybody in the world can watch that online. You don't need to have this shared publicity event like you once did. So it is really today kind of just CES is about marketing. And, you know, maybe in a way, too, it's a good thing that it's returning to its roots, that a lot of it is just people doing business. It's, all right, I need to get here and find a distributor or a manufacturer for my product.
But is it still worth going to?
It's worth going to if you're really deep into the industry, if you cover it, or if you make something for a couple of reasons. One is because it still is a critical mass of people in the tech business. If you just want to get to know people, if you want to meet people in the industry, this is the place where they're most likely to be. It's also valuable because it is a chance to go and see all these products firsthand. I would never have a chance outside of CES to go and be like, oh, here's the cool internet-connected refrigerator, and over here I'm going to find some weird Japanese vibrating electrical machine. That's where you're going to discover all this stuff, and it's a nice opportunity to see everything like that.
Well, David Ewald, thanks for filling us in.
Well, thank you for having me.
David Ewald, contributing editor at Forbes, where he writes about games and technology. He's just returned from the Consumer Electronics Show. And you can check out some of the cool stuff that was showcased at the CES last week at wordofmouthradio.org. And from the iPhone to Tesla cars, successful tech products are often praised for their sleek designs and functionality. Up next, we're going to dig into an important but often underappreciated part of the design process, sound. We'll listen to that when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When creating new technologies, developers have a lot to consider. Will it function properly? Is it user-friendly? Is it well-designed? How much will it cost? And what will it sound like? Roman Mars of 99% Invisible uncovers an important but often overlooked part of the next big thing, sound design.
Without all the beeps, without sonic feedback, all of your modern conveniences would be very hard to use.
I mean, try using your telephone without the beeps, and it's really confusing. You're lost immediately. Did I get it? No, I didn't get it. The number's there, but I didn't hear it. I used to get it physically with the rotary.
S for sound.
This whole world is artificial.
When I started, I was working with this guy at the Advanced Product Group at Apple.
Sound.
And he had a case for a Walkman, I think. And he opened it up and he closed it and you heard it click. And he said,
somebody worked really hard to make that click sound that way.
Walkman flavor.
That was an acoustical element on a mechanical device.
Well, there aren't a lot of moving parts and mechanical bits in today's devices, but Jim McKee still has to make them sound right.
My name is Jim McKee, and I have a company called Earwax Productions. We do sound for film, radio, internet, and product sound design.
Quite simply, a product sound designer looks at a product and thinks, what kind of sound should this thing make when it does a particular thing?
So typically what I do is I create a bunch of button sounds.
These are would-be buttons for a Yahoo widget.
And say, okay, you guys tell me which ones are the closest, and then you end up with, 38 sounds here.
I love that. I could listen to that all day. In fact, let's hear it again. Oh, yeah. The best sounds are not completely synthesized. They come from the everyday world.
My top drawer, my dresser drawer at home, over the years, I've been collecting all these little things. You know, just I would like, oh, cool, a marble, and I would leave it there. Or, oh, cool, there's this little tiny Chinese ceramic bowl, or, you know, some kind of funky clip. And I realized that all these things are very kind of intimate to me, very close to me, but they make sounds. And the one cool one was dropping a small marble into this china bowl, and it has a dynamic to it, which everybody's familiar with. It bounces, but then it bounce.
That's the marble sped up and compressed and EQ'd and who knows what.
All sorts of things. Actually, the funniest one, the one that everybody loved and it seems to have stuck more or less across the board, is the sound of a vice grip opening up, because it's got the click and the spring. And for some reason, it really works and people like the way it sounds. I think you can hear almost the same sound when you plug in your iPhone to get powered. You know that? Oh no, when you turn it on. Hear it?
Oh yeah, I do.
If the device and its sounds are designed correctly, it creates a special theater of the mind that you completely buy into. Electronic things feel mechanical. It's the feeling of movement, texture, and articulation where none exists. On Jim McKee's most recent phone project, the sounds that worked best were the ones you felt.
Resonating quality of the sound in relationship to the chassis itself is what sold it. It's like, oh, that really feels like it's part of this thing.
And once you find those frequencies that resonate in a device, you keep exploring that space.
Almost got to the point where I didn't even have to ask them which one they were going to select, because I would give them half a dozen ones to pick from, varying in volume, varying slightly in pitch, and I'd go, okay, it's going to be 46B. And they'd come back and go, I don't know why, but that seems to work a lot better. You take any actor and put them in a room, and they're immediately going to find the size of the room with their voice, right? It's just human nature. And so why can't we expect the same thing out of our devices? You know, it needs to feel like it's indigenous to this piece of plastic.
And that story came to us from Roman Mars of 99% Invisible. And we're going to move from the sounds of technology to the sounds of sport. A not-so-brief and extremely sordid history of cheerleading. That's when Word of Mouth returns.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 2014 was not a great year for the NFL. Its settlement over concussion litigation was criticized as too little too late. The league also faced scrutiny over violence off the field against children and partners of players. And for five teams, lawsuits from their own cheerleaders. Cheering squads for the Buffalo Bills, the Cincinnati Bengals, the New York Jets, Oakland Raiders, and Tampa Bay Buccaneers filed suits claiming that in some cases they were paid as little as $5 an hour to sex up the sidelines for the multi-billion dollar league games. Today's skimpily dressed cheerleaders are a far cry from the all-male squads that rooted for the Ivy League a century ago. Mother Jones reporter Julia Lurie wrote a not-so-brief and extremely sordid history of cheerleading for the magazine. Julia Lurie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much.
What is the first record you found of cheerleading?
So cheerleading seems to have gotten started in the late 1800s. It's really closely tied to football. So we have the first collegiate football game in 1869, Princeton against Rutgers. And by the 1880s, it seems that Princeton has an all-male pep squad. So indeed, it is a very far cry from what we have as far as cheerleading today.
So how were they regarded, these, you know, suddenly people jumping around on the sidelines?
You know, it's a good question. And they were actually the very sort of the cream of the crop. It was seen as a very elite thing to do. You have a Nation article from early in the 1900s saying that the reputation of a cheerleader is one of the most valuable things a boy can take away from college.
Hmm. Those were all male squads initially. When did women start cheering?
It became really more popular for women to cheer in the 40s. That coincided with men going away for World War II. So women sort of take over and then continue to stay in that role.
Oh, so it was like Rosie the cheerleader.
Exactly.
When did it sort of make the jump to major sports leagues like the NFL?
That was in the late 50s and early 60s. And the NFL league was the first league to have a lot of pro cheerleading teams. By the late 60s, most of the NFL teams have some sort of cheerleading squad. And some of the cheerleading squads started off as like a team of high school girls or college girls that were doing this. It was not necessarily like a professional thing.
Well, you write about the cheerleading squad sort of reflecting social mores and movements like the women's movement, civil mm-hmm. rights. Give us some examples of how.
In the late 60s and early 70s, looking at this history, you see riots in a number of towns after black cheerleaders aren't elected to teams at newly integrated high schools. So this got as extreme as in 1969, there were 400 National Guard troops who were brought into a North Carolina town called Burlington because of these riots. In terms of the women's movement, you sort of had this interesting pairing in the early 70s where Title IX passes, but at the same time, there's this move, especially among pro cheerleading teams, NFL teams, to make cheerleading more entertaining and have it be more of like a sexy dance. So you have a lot of outcry from feminists at the time for these really revealing outfits and, you know, for sort of selling this sexuality. But at the same time, you know, this is gaining a lot of traction among football teams.
When did it become that kind of sexed up, previously mid-thigh skirts turned into what one team owner recently called booty shorts? When did all that happen?
So early 70s, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys named Tex Schramm decided that he wanted his cheerleaders to be more entertaining. And the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders developed this really sexy uniform. So you have the booty shorts and the crop top and high boots. And that was a big hit. It was controversial, but it was getting a lot of attention. And soon after, you have a lot of teams following suit. And, you know, by the early 80s, almost all of the teams, you know, had that kind of look.
Well, it's interesting because the Dallas Cowgirls, as you point out, make mm-hmm. the cover of Esquire magazine. But there's this kind of walking this come hither and wholesome line at the same time.
Exactly.
What was the behavior that was expected of the major league cheerleaders?
Right. I mean, that's totally true. You're sort of supposed to be very pure, but at the same time, you know, really sexy. Like, you want me, but you can't have me. So you have very strict rules for how you're supposed to look in your uniform and, you know, makeup and hair and your weight. But at the same time, very strict rules about what you can and can't do off of the field. So there's, in a lot of teams, there's absolutely no fraternizing. If you see football players off the field, you're supposed to have absolutely no contact with them. For some teams, that means that the cheerleaders have to leave wherever they are, if they're at like a restaurant or bar or something like that. So you have this very rigid line between sort of the purity and the sexiness. One example is in 1978, a member of the San Diego Chargers cheerleading team is fired after modeling for Playboy. And also a lot of just controlled behavior about what you can and can't say. So a lot of teams prohibit their cheerleaders from talking about their wages, prohibit their cheerleaders from talking about the public appearances they have to make for free, prohibit their cheerleaders from talking to the press without permission from the team.
Have they always been so poorly paid? I mean, we heard this past fall in lawsuits that they would wait around for hours and hours and hours, be paid very little, a lot mm-hmm. of restrictions about their behavior. Is this the first attempt that we've seen for better conditions for cheerleaders?
Almost, not quite. In the mid-90s, the Buffalo Bills cheerleaders, and their name is the Buffalo Jills, form a very short-lived union called the National Football League Cheerleaders Association. And the idea was to raise pay for cheerleaders and give more squad members say about the uniforms that they could wear and, you know, what they did. Because at the time, the Jills weren't paid for practice or travel. And this seems to have been
for enormous. Travel, they'd go to games across the country and they had to pay for their own travel?
So mostly they would go to home games. There was a case for the Jills when they had to fly themselves to the Super Bowl.
Wow.
And even up to the present where you're like, wait, you have to pay for that? in the case of calendars, a lot of cheerleading teams have calendars where their squad members pose, and for some teams, the squad members have to buy the calendars and then go ahead to sell them. And if they don't make their money back, then it falls on them.
When did cheerleading become ultra popular and even come to signal popularity, especially among middle school girls and high school girls? Can you put a number on that?
It was a sort of steady rise, starting really like in the 50s. By 1975, you have 500,000 students from elementary school to college participating in cheerleading. By the 70s, it seems to have become very popular, both in high schools and also in like cheerleading clinics and camps, that sort of thing.
Julie, it's so interesting to me because cheerleading is kind of associated with a kind of slice of American life, right? But a certain sector of American culture and has often been used as a tool in the culture wars. Give us some examples and why you think cheerleading, I guess, typifies that in a way.
I mean, as recently as 2012, this was an issue in a small town in Texas. 15 high school cheerleaders and their parents sued their school district after the district had banned the cheerleaders from displaying banners with Bible verses on them. And several prominent politicians, including Rick Perry and Ted Cruz, expressed their support for these cheerleaders. So that's something that you might not necessarily see coming, but I think when you follow a history for this long, you end up seeing a lot of the social movements and cultural wars of the time sort of playing out in something like cheerleading.
Interesting. You don't see cheerleaders at soccer games. Is this a distinctly American phenomenon?
It definitely started here, and it's become more popular abroad, but it is predominantly still very American, and also predominantly in football and now basketball and some hockey.
I've always wondered about that. With cheerleaders so popular in other big league sports, why not in baseball?
I think partly because cheerleading started with football in its origins and sort of grew as football grew. And that never really happened with baseball or with most other sports.
Well, Julia Laurie, what a tour we've had. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Mother Jones reporter Julia Laurie put together a not-so-brief and extremely sordid history of cheerleading for Mother Jones. You might want to see it for yourself. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And we're going to linger on the sidelines for a bit longer with an inside look at the world of amateur and professional mascots. What drives someone to put on a furry costume and a giant head? Amy O'Leary traveled to Portland, Maine to find out.
There's something about walking in and picking up the costume that he hadn't worn in a couple of days and taking a big, smell of it, just kind of see where the costume stands. And you're like, yeah, okay, I'm getting in this for a couple hours.
Tim Chalmers is arguably the premier professional mascot in Maine. He's represented sports teams, products, anyone who needs a guy who can work a crowd from inside a giant foam head. Tim likes to keep his costumes in his basement, in front of a big floor fan, where he's got more control over airing them out. Down here, there are two giant nylon bags that look like beanbag chairs. He pulls one character out of the bag.
And this is actually Okie.
Okie is an acorn, representing the Oakhurst Dairy.
It looks like a giant teacup. A golden teacup with holes in the side for the arms.
I should tell you that besides Okie, Tim performs in costume anywhere he can. During baseball season, he's Slugger the Sea Dog.
Slugger. Slugger is a great character.
At other times, he's been the Key Bank Key, the Mercy Hospital Mercy Bear, Clocky, which was some kind of New Year's Eve character, and Crackers, the mascot for the Portland Pirates minor league hockey team.
And with Crackers, you have, you get a beak, which kind of comes over where, you look out the mouth. But, coming out in the ice, they kill the house lights. And spotlights, and you're trying to skate out to center ice, and you're looking at the ground, you can't see your feet. Plus, your feet are oversized, and then skate.
This is what it sounds like inside the parrot head. Thousands of fans are watching him skate in a 6-foot green fur bird costume. What's he thinking out there?
Not bad, didn't fall.
After the national anthem, Tim comes off the ice, and now the fun part begins. It's showtime, and that means a couple of things. One, he doesn't talk when he's performing. Anything he wants to say, he's got to say with two fur-covered hands. But he's really good at it. With hand gestures, he can say anything from a basic thumbs up to the most complicated thing I've seen him do, which was tell one kid a knock-knock joke from start to finish. But the most important thing you need to know, if you see Tim perform, is to never ask for Tim when he's in the costume. You and his mom and his girlfriend and his nephew, you have to ask for crackers.
What I'm trying to portray is, you know, taking people out of their regular routine and, you know, making them wave and recognize who the character is, and me getting into costume does that for me. You know, it takes me out of that kind of your routine of going to class or whatever, you know. It's not work to me.
It's 5 a.m., and Tim's getting ready for a two-hour drive to Mount Ida College in Boston.
Please start.
Although he'd like to be a professional mascot, he's studying for a new career.
I think, A, geographically, where I'm at, you know, there's no professional teams really up here. B, you know, I like to believe I'm the caliber of a professional mascot, but probably not.
So Tim's backup plan, the thing he's falling back on instead of a career as a professional mascot? Mortuary science.
Like I said, I always had the thoughts of wanting to learn more about mortuary science and do that sort of thing. And I wanted to wait till I was around 30. Work for 20 years and then, you know, be a 55-year-old mascot.
So for now, Tim's in class. One of his professors, Freda Gordon, sees similarities in the work Tim does in class and in costume.
They have to be able to communicate with a huge variety of different personalities and be sensitive to it. And it fits in being a mascot. I mean, you stand for something. And in funeral service, you represent something to these people, often their last opportunity to say goodbye.
But Tim's two jobs go together in other ways. He's got a busted glove in his Crackers costume, and he's going to be stitching it up using a technique he learned in embalming class. But not everyone sees the connection. Rodney Mondor went to mascot boot camp with Tim, and he sees things differently.
Interesting. I say being a mascot is the same as being a funeral director. I guess both is that you're there for a purpose. So whatever, to take care of the crowd. But they're really two extremes. Interesting. People actually say that? They think that they're this one and the same? Do you think they're one and the same, Tim?
You know, you're reacting to the, you know, the emotions and reactions of the other people. You're kind of setting the tone. You know, you're trying to be in control. Yeah, and I think the extreme excitement, the adverse is for, like, extreme sorrow and empathy, compassion, sadness.
I'll buy that.
I'm not trying to sell you.
Tim's just 2 weeks away from graduation. He's finishing up his internship at a Portland funeral home where he's assisted on more than 20 embalmings. He likes his work there, but ultimately he prefers putting on a costume instead of a suit, even for something as small as a grocery store appearance like this one.
Mom, look! Come say hi to him!
Well, ideally you'd just be doing appearances. Like I said, there's just something about playing to a big crowd. Yeah, although Mickey Mouse got a good gig. Yeah, he's got it going on.
Crackers. You say crackers?
Crackers. I'd love to work for, you know, I think a professional baseball team. I think ideally it'd be the dream job, so to speak. You know, the famous chicken's got it going on. He travels around. He gets paid to do his thing. You know, it's all on his terms. So he's probably got the ideal job.
Yeah, he's a funny bird, isn't he?
Is he trying to peck you on the head?
Yes.
Tim starts his new job at the funeral home in a couple of weeks. He's worried that when he does, he may not have enough time to continue performing. So in the meantime, he's squeezing in as much as he can.
That's Crackers. Funny guy.
We got a little update to that story. Tim is no longer a mascot for the Pirates, but he did follow through on his backup plan and is now a funeral director at Hobbs Funeral Home in Portland, Maine. Thanks so much for listening in today. If you like what you heard, there's much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We also invite you to follow us or send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. We find the most interesting stuff comes to us via word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more tomorrow, too, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.